Wow. So, it's good to see you all. So, look, I want to just bring you up to speed for those guys who are either new or weren't here last week. That we're starting a little bit of a new series. Normally, we'll teach every verse of every chapter of every book in the Bible. That's kind of the goal. If we live that long, right? Or if Jesus doesn't come back before. Because it like took us 2.5 years to get through Ephesians, so you know, whatever. So normally we teach verse by verse, chapter by chapter through a book of the Bible. We believe that's faithful to the scriptures. We believe that's faithful to how it was written. And that's normal. That's normal for us to do that. At the moment, what we're looking at is a little mini series, 6 weeks. I think we're going to do it over 8 weeks, but. A six-week series on We Are Calvary. What does it mean to be Calvary? What does it mean to be the church? Who are we? How do we work together? How do we survive? That kind of stuff. It's a little bit different now than we would normally do. But this morning we are in Colossians chapter 1. But before we do get into the text, I just want to do something a little bit differently. I want to just do a quick survey. And understand that there is a point to this eventually. Eventually there will be a point. Play along if you would. Just a couple of quick questions. And as we kind of raise our hands, I want you to look around and see kind of the people that we have amongst us. So just stick up your hand if you did not, and I'm going to play along if I remember, if you did not grow up in a Christian home. Yeah, just keep your hands up. Keep your hands right up and look around. Just look around you. Yeah, okay. So put your hands down. And be your hand up if you did grow up in a Christian home. Wow. Okay, so keep your hands up, guys. Keep your hands up. But if you grew up in a Christian home, but at some stage, maybe your teenage years, you drifted away. You walked away from God. At one point, your parents' faith was not your faith. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, put your hands down. There's a lot of us, you know, like that, right? So how many of you came to know Christ before your 20th birthday? Yeah, wow. And continue to look around, guys. You need to know who's amongst you. Okay, so put your hands down. How many came to know Christ before your 30th birthday? Yeah, well. And how about before your 40th birthday? No, seriously, there should be the same amount of hands, shouldn't there? I mean, how does that work? My maths is terrible, but even I know that doesn't work. Okay, so put your hands down. How about you got saved between, and I know this is dangerous territory, just be honest with me, how many people got saved between the age of 40, and your 40th birthday counts, don't be panickety, between your 40th birthday and your 50th birthday? No one. Wow. How about 20th to 30th birthday? Yeah. You guys bucked the trend. All right, good. But you have some. How about, how many of you are from homes whose parents are still happily married? Yeah, check that out. Yeah, it's like, please define happy. Joe, get your hand up. You're sitting next to your mother. What's going on with that? Yeah, happily. It's just define that. Actually, we're going to start studying in Philippines after we finished, and that's going to be the pursuit of happiness, the series. And so that defines kind of like, okay, what do we mean by happy? This is getting personal now, but how many of you come from a home where your parents maybe divorced when you were a teen, say? Yeah, a few of you. Yeah, a few of you. Okay, thanks, guys. Wait, just trust me. We're in a safe environment here, right? So how many of you guys came from a past of struggling with drugs or alcohol? Yeah. Yeah, and some of you are still there, right? How about how many of you have come out of some kind of history of abuse of any kind? Any kind, yeah. Yeah, God bless you guys. So, all right, let's move out of that. And how many of you would say that, or how many of you, let's put it in different circumstances, how many of you are, I'm just trying to think of the best way to phrase this. How many of you have, already have, a bachelor's level degree or higher? Yeah. So a bachelor's level degree or higher. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So we're a pretty, it doesn't understand that, yeah. We're a pretty degreed bunch, right? Doesn't mean we're smart, it just means we're degreed. Here's the lie that I want to point out. Here's the thing, right? One of the greatest myths about our faith, one of the greatest myths about Christianity is that there is a type of person who becomes a Christian. Right? And even in our small sample size, you know, that is ridiculous. You just see how ridiculous. I mean, we're all over the map in many different areas. Some of us grew up in homes where our parents talked to us about Jesus. Some didn't. There are those who were abused growing up. Some weren't. Some were loved well growing up. There are those here that didn't even get GCSEs. Some are PhDs and everything in between, right? There are some who have partied and some who have partied hard and some who have partied not at all. Some who struggle deeply still with their past and people who struggle deeply with their future and so on and so on. We are a mixed bunch, aren't we? And the point is that God saves. And the truth, that singular truth, is really still mind-blowing to me. You know, that he would take that person and that person and that person and that person all the way over here and save them and then say, come to me into one body and get on. And not just get on in terms of bearing with one another, because we can all do that for a couple of hours, right? But actually, you need to love on each other and encourage each other and support each other even when you don't feel like it. And so God doesn't need a particular set of circumstances in order for you to be saved. I mean, he doesn't require you to have been brought up in Ned Flanders' house for you to be saved, right? He doesn't need that. He saves from all kinds of walks of life. You don't need the Christian growing up experience, but also you don't need the rebel's experience either, right? He takes all people from all walks of life and all backgrounds and all contexts out of them and he saves them. And the mind-blowing thing is this, he then calls on those people not just to get along, but in that getting along to act like Jesus. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. Again, last week we talked about the six-week series entitled We Are Calvary, Exploring the Church and six commitments that all of us are called to make as we live the Christian life together. And here they are on the screen. There's six commitments. There you go. So the commitment to love, the commitment to unity, the commitment to put God first, which is ironically third in our list, the commitment to serve. That got pointed out to me last week. I was like, why didn't you say that before I started the series? And they didn't know. So there you go. So, yeah, that's to check you're awake. That's right. God bless you. Thank you. The commitment to serve, the commitment to grow, and the commitment to disciple. And so this morning I want us to turn to Colossians 1. We're going to be in Colossians 1, then we're going to go to Ephesians 4. And then we're actually going to bounce around quite a few places this morning. But this is the commitment to unity. And I want to frame it in the gospel. Okay? Everything that we do individually or as a church should flow out of our understanding of the gospel. I mean, if it doesn't, it's a really big problem. I have some concerns, concerns about some of the things that we do as a church, other churches do as churches that they're led to in their convictions, that when you trace it back to what that says about the gospel, it paints a very poor picture about the gospel. And so we need to be thinking, okay, well, if unity is something that we're called to commit to, how does that reflect the gospel? How does the gospel reflect how what we do each and every day as Christians? But before we kind of touch on Colossians 1, it's worth remembering that God's intention for mankind in the beginning was to be in community, just like he is. And so Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, God created man in his image. In the image God created him, male and female, he created them. So in his own image. And we're told that God himself is one, right? Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. John chapter 17, verse 22, Jesus says, The glory that you, that is the Father, he's praying, the glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. Galatians 3:20 says, God is one. And so in the beginning, God created after his own image. He created us after his image, a God who is one and yet three, living in eternal relational unity, which tells us that we are born to relate, we're born to be in a relationship, we're born to be in community, firstly with God and then with others. And the purpose of this unity is that when we go out into this world, as we saw last week, we would fill this world with the image of God. This unity between us and God and then each other would be the reflection of who God is. So thinking about God's intention, turn to Colossians 1. And Paul is going to say, in this short passage that we're going to look at, he's going to say that there are two opposing camps. I don't really like the word camps, but I really just couldn't figure out a better word to use, right? So you'll forgive me. Two families, two camps, two teams, however you want to, what word you want to use. I think they all have negative connotations and some positives. So two camps. And all of us belong to one camp or the other. So one of us belongs to one camp, one team, one family, or we belong to the other camp or the other family or the other team. And we are united by that fact. Okay? So every person who has ever lived and will ever live belongs to one of two camps, one of two teams, one of two families. You are either in the before Christ camp or you are in the after Christ camp. Right? There's no real middle ground there. You're either moving towards, or you're in it moving towards, or you're in the other one. And he'll say that you're either without Christ or you're with Christ. Two camps. Okay? You're either outside of Christ or you're in Christ. Two camps. And the thing that has made us go from one camp to the other is the gospel of Jesus. Okay? So two camps, two opposing camps, two camps that don't collide. And the thing that has taken us from one camp to the other is this thing called the gospel. This is how he puts it. Look at Colossians 1:21. And you, who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. So Paul says that you were once, at one time, you were once alienated. That's the first thing that we all have in common. That if we're in that camp, that's the whole world has this in common, all united by this one thing. And rather than be united in God as his image bearers in the world, as originally intended, Adam and Eve, you know the story, destroyed that unity by taking the fruit in the garden. That caused alienation, that caused separation from God. And because it caused separation from God, it caused separation from each other, right? I mean, that's kind of like the basic story of the fall, right? And so this alienation that Paul talks about then is the result of sin. Look at James chapter 4, verse 1. James says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? What is it? Well, he goes on and says, is it not that your passions are at war within you? And so sin causes alienation between God, between us and God and us and each other. Let's keep going. He says, and you who were once alienated and hostile in mind. So what ends up happening is when we're alienated from God and continue to try and get from this life what this life cannot give us, we begin to grow hostile in mind. That word hostile is enemy. We are at enmity, or we are enemies of everyone, including God, both in attitude and in action. I mean, in fact, the Bible declares that at one time we were at war with God. Romans chapter 8, verse 7. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God. Hostile to God. Which means that we look for someone, within our happiness, within looking for life in life but never finding it, which is what Ecclesiastes is about, right? We find someone to blame for our unhappiness. We grow hostile in mind. And then look what happens next at the end of verse 21. And you who were once alienated and hostile, doing evil deeds. We're alienated. We're brought into the lie that what we need is more of what we already possess, which hasn't satisfied us. It hasn't satisfied us, so we need more of that, which is a lie, because more of nothing is still nothing, right? And so we bought into life, I have more of nothing, that's going to satisfy me. It doesn't. That leads us to a hostility of blaming others for our unhappiness, which then leads to evil deeds. This is how evil deeds show up on the radar. They don't just come out of nowhere. They come from this alienation. And all of us were in the same position once. All of us. That's one of the two things that we have in common, strangely united by our separation in separation. Strange. But look at this next thing. Look at the second thing. He says, and you who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, verse 22, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. So he, that is Jesus, has reconciled you to God. He has removed the alienation that leads to his hostility of mind, that leads to evil deeds, which means that until you deal with alienation, blame and frustration are always going to be the benchmarks of your spiritual and mental and emotional life. Let me say that again. Until you deal with that alienation, you're always in trouble. Always. Until that alienation from God is dealt with, you're always going to be hostile and evil deeds and evil towards others. What Paul is saying is this, that the vertical relationship is always going to affect our horizontal relationship. Our vertical relationship to God is always going to affect our horizontal relationships to others. So Paul says that Jesus, as a result of this, Jesus, in his body of flesh, he says in the text, Jesus in his body of flesh, which is the incarnation, right? God in the flesh comes and lives a perfect, spotless, blameless, above reproach life. By his death, in his body of flesh, by his death, dies on the cross and is resurrected. He reconciles you to God. This is the great exchange, right? This is the wonderful thing about the gospel. Christ gets your hostile mind and your evil deeds. He gets my hostile mind and my evil deeds, and he pays for them in full. And I get his righteousness, his spotlessness, and we become above reproach before God. Now that's cool. You don't get that by any act of your own. You don't get that by trying harder or being better or being good. You get that as an act of God in Jesus. That's the good news. The good news is not that you can clean yourself up, and if you do, God will like you. And God will approve of you. Your hope and my hope is tied into the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that our hostility and alienation are removed from us by Jesus, and we are now reconciled to God. That is the gospel. And look, if you ever want to remember the gospel, three words: incarnation, substitution, restoration. That's the gospel. Incarnation, who Jesus is; substitution, what Jesus did; restoration, what Jesus brings. That's the gospel. And it's the gospel that solves the problem of alienation. It's the gospel that solves the problem of how we get from one camp to the other. It's the gospel that moves us from before Christ to after Christ, without Christ to with Christ, outside of Christ to in Christ. And if you're a Christian, now we will have this in common. You know, before we're a Christian, we had this in common. We were united by this thing. But now we have moved, we are united by this thing. And so we are united by one thing or the other. We have now been reconciled to God and God's purpose in reconciling us to himself. Ephesians 1 verse 10 is to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. And the scope of this reconciliation, how broad is that? How wide is that reconciliation? What do we mean by unity? The scope of this reconciliation is not that we have just been brought near, although that is true. The effect is that we are now hidden in Christ. So it's not that we've just been brought near, we're actually hidden in the very person of Jesus Christ. And that's what Paul says in Colossians chapter 3. Just flick over the page. There, Colossians 3, verse 3. He says, for you have died. Your old life is gone. Your debt has been paid. You are free. It is before Christ. You're in that camp. It's all done and dusted. It's been dealt with. For you have died. And your life is hidden with Christ in God. And the point is that as you look around today, as you looked around you this morning, even in this small gathering, we are united by Christ, we have been reconciled by Jesus. And now the reason for understanding the gospel starts to become clearer, because it helps us to understand the gospel clearly as we live out our daily lives and live out the life of the church and trying to commit to maintaining unity. So, for example, in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1, Paul says, I urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you are called. Right? So we've always got to keep the gospel in mind. Walk worthy. That doesn't mean walk so that you are now worthy to be called a Christian. You have attained some kind of level of perfection. He's saying it's axios, it's a balance. Just as you have been saved, so walk in that same degree, that same oneness. Walk in the manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. Walk according to the gospel that saved you. And one of the ways that we are to do that, look in verse 3 of Ephesians chapter 4, is that we are eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. One of the outworkings of the gospel, where God takes that person, that person, that person, and that person from way over there, and he takes them from that camp and he moves them into his camp on his team, and he unites them together in one. The reason he does that is so that we can then show the world, actually, look, it's not about staying in our camp, it's about how we live together. That displays the gospel. And he says, look, Paul says there in Ephesians 4 that we should be eager to maintain the unity. That's not something, that word maintain, it's helpful because, again, it tells us the scope of unity. That unity is brought how? How do we come together? How has Jesus done that? He's brought us together by the gospel. Incarnation, substitution, restoration. And we only maintain unity, we don't create unity. Right? Because he's done that. So we only maintain unity with those who have been given unity. We are to maintain what has already been given. And if it's not been given, we can't maintain it. Which means we can't maintain unity, for example, with Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, we might love them. We might witness to them. We might spend a lot of our time talking to them and try and speak to them about the truth of Jesus Christ. But we can't maintain unity. Why? Because they deny the gospel. I mean, they deny the incarnation of Jesus, right? We said the gospel is the incarnation, substitution, restoration. The incarnation, who Jesus is. They don't believe in the Jesus that we believe in, right? They believe that Jesus was a created being. He's Michael the Archangel. But that's not the same Jesus that we believe in. So there's no unity there. So we can't maintain it with Jehovah's Witnesses, even though we would seek for them to move into the same camp that we are in so we can have unity, right? The same could be said of the Roman Catholic Church, for example. See, whilst they hold fast and very firmly to the incarnation, they deny the sufficiency of the substitution. That's a problem. Why? There can't be unity there to maintain either. So look, this verse tells us that we shouldn't be joining hands as a show of unity with those who don't hold to the gospel. Simply what Paul is saying is that the gospel brings people together from every tribe, every nation, every people, and every language, where before there was separation. That's what Jesus does. That's what Jesus does in the gospel. And then as a result, we are to live as if that reconciliation, that coming together is an absolute unity, is an absolute reality. So what does this say about how we do church? So we've kind of laid out the kind of theological foundation. How should this then translate into how we do church? Because look, unity is something that all churches struggle with. I have never been in a church where unity has not been an issue. And if it's not been an issue, it's because it's been brushed under the carpet, and sooner or later it has become an issue, a very big one. And so even, you know, in the letters that are written in the New Testament, I mean, just flick to 1 Corinthians 10 and you'll see this, or 1 Corinthians 11, you'll see this. You know, Paul, he says there in verse 17 of 1 Corinthians 11, he says, "But in the following instruction, I do not commend you." I mean, imagine receiving a letter from the Apostle Paul where he says, "What I'm about to say, it's not good for you. This is not a glowing report. I don't praise you for this." Why? He says, "Because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse." Well, that's pretty harsh, right? Can you imagine? Actually, when you come together, when you get together on a Sunday, look, it's not good. It's actually, when you get together, it would be better if you didn't meet than if you met. Because when you do meet, it just makes matters worse. Wow. They're going to church. Well, that's good. But the outcome wasn't good. Instead of building one another up, they are tearing each other down. Instead of exalting Christ in their fellowship and worship, they're diminishing him by attacking each other. They were, by their actions, denying the gospel that has reconciled them as true believers into one body. And he kind of sticks in some examples of what was going on. He says there in verse 18, he says, "For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions amongst you. And I believe that in part, for there must be factions among you in order to for those who are genuine among you to be recognized." He's saying, look, I've heard that there are divisions in the church. And I can understand that because only some of you are saved. And there has to be division. Otherwise, we wouldn't know which ones are saved and which ones aren't saved. He's being sarcastic. He says, there's people in the church, you're not even acting like you're a Christian. There are some, but most of them, there's not. There's some that aren't. And we know from chapter 1, actually, in 1 Corinthians, that there were those who were saying, you know, "I follow Paul," or "I follow Apollos," or "I follow Peter," or "I follow Christ." And they were divided over personalities and giftedness instead of being united under Christ. And whilst all of that is going on, Paul gives another two reasons for their divisions in the next couple of verses. And he's going to say, look, there's socioeconomic differences and there's just basically flat out insensitivity. He says in verse 20, "When you come together, is it not the Lord's Supper that you eat? For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you in this?" No, I'm not going to do that. There were people coming to the communion table with their love feasts and on all this extravagant food. And there were people in the fellowship that didn't have 2 cents to rub together and feed themselves. And they weren't supporting each other. And he says, should I say, "Oh, well done"? No, I'm not going to say well done, because that's appalling. whether it was personality driven, socioeconomic driven, or just mere insensitivity, they were driven and divided over petty differences. Now, what does that say about the way their church is shaped by the gospel? They didn't understand the gospel, did they? What does that say about the way our church is shaped by the gospel? Because if we simply just reflect the exact same cultural differences that are present in society, that doesn't show us to be any different from society. Doesn't there have to be something wrong with the way that we understand the gospel or the way that we're applying it? And the implication being that the Corinthian church needed to set aside those differences, and so do we. And so the second commitment is simply this. And I'm just going to read it out for you. It says, I commit to be a unifying presence in the church as a display of Christ's unifying presence in the world through the gospel. You say, well, that's kind of a mouthful. What does that mean? All right, let me break it down for you. What does that look like for us here in this fellowship? I think I've got three things. And there's way more than three things. But what we're doing on a Wednesday night is that we're gathering to hash some of this stuff out. It's where you bring your questions. It's when you bring your critique. It's when you bring your encouragement. And we just hash it out together. And that's a challenge, especially when we're talking about unity. So the first thing is that we break down all barriers. And the word implicit is all barriers. You know, in recent years, there's been this uniformity where, you know, we're supposed to be all the same. We look all the same. We're kind of like die cut, carbon cut people, Christians. We're all supposed to look the same. And there's just been this move of uniformity that is driven by evangelistic zeal. The idea is that people come to Christ faster if they have fewer barriers to break down coming to Christ, right? And in some parts, I agree with that statement. And so what you see is churches lower certain barriers to enable other certain people to come to Christ without them experiencing any kind of deep culture shock, right? Because the church is quite a weird place. I mean, if you think about it, for someone who's non-churched to come into, you know, this environment, it is quite strange. And so to break down those barriers, what we have seen over recent years is more churches trying to reach specific segments of the population. But, you know, that kind of thinking is hard to square with what Paul says about the church in Ephesians 2. Because in Ephesians 2, this is what he says, verse 12. He says, remember that you were at that time separated from Christ. And look at just the words that Paul uses. You were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope, without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one, and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of his hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man. How many is that? Good. One new man. He is creating one new man in place of the two, Jew and Gentile, he's referring to. So making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. I mean, Paul in Ephesians 2 paints the picture of two radically different groups of people. Before Christ, after Christ, without Christ, with Christ, outside Christ, in Christ. And here, we even within the context, you know, people who have been reconciled together into one. People have been brought out from their different contexts, their backgrounds, their upbringing, their understanding. They've been brought into one. And the problem with lowering barriers just for one group of people is that you automatically raise the barriers for everybody else, right? So for example, if you create, and there's a couple around out there, if you create a church just for goths, if you don't know what a goth is, ask someone under 20. If you create a church just for goths, you automatically exclude everyone who's not a goth, right? If you create a church just for skaters, I ain't going. Because I can't skate. And when I do, I break stuff. Like bones. Instead of saying, and here's the problem with that. Instead of saying, I will become all things to all men that I might save some, you're actually saying, I will become all things to some men. And it's important that everyone not only feels welcome, but people who are like us and people who aren't like us. People who we naturally drift towards and people we naturally drift away from. And Paul continually talks about this all the way through, as the church is not made up of separate groups of different kinds of people staying outside of their own, inside their own little bubbles, but the church is a mixture of people. I mean, look, Titus chapter 2, verse 2. You know, how can a church, for example, who only reaches university students, right? How can a church whose mission is to only reach university students obey the instructions for the church that Paul gives in Titus 2? Where he says, older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, to train young women to love their husbands and children. How does that work if in a church, if everyone's under 22? Right? I mean, basically, what you're going to see, do the 25-year-olds get categorized as older men and older women at 25? I mean, probably, but I don't think that's Paul's objective. I mean, doesn't it sound like Paul's objective is to see the church that spans generations? How does the church that only consists of rich people, and there are churches that their mission statement is to reach rich people, right? And you think I'm bonkers, but they exist. How do they obey James chapter 2? Because there in James chapter 2, we're told not to favor the rich man, but honor the one who looks shabby. If you've got none of those people in your church, how do you do that? It's a great idea, but it's misplaced pragmatism. Whilst we should applaud the desire to see people come to Christ from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, from all styles, from wherever they are, we should use what God has said he would use to bring people to Christ, which is the love of Christ displayed in the gospel being worked out in the unity of the church, being all things to all men in the hope to win some. So we are to break down barriers, absolutely, but we are to break them all down and be very careful about building ones up. Secondly, we are to root out legalism. We could spend a while looking at this. We might. By legalism, I mean an extra set of rules that we are to live by. All right? So that's what I mean by legalism. It's an extra set of rules that we are to live by. You see, if every one of us has to make the exact same choice about every extra biblical matter, then people coming in will realize two things. They'll realize that they not only have to get on Jesus's team, they also have to get on ours. They not only know that they have to sign up to Jesus's program, but they often have to sign up to our program. What I mean by that, if we all dress the same, to get into our program, everybody else has to dress the same. You with me? You know, if we all like the same music, to get into that program means everybody else having to like our music. So it's really worth asking ourselves, what rules do we have to keep in order to be welcomed, fully welcomed into our church? Which is a great question to kind of think about and kind of ponder. And again, we can talk about this on Wednesday. What rules do we have to keep in order to be fully welcomed in the church? One of the rules that we don't, I want to put this out there straight away, you may have noticed, one of the rules that we don't have is that you don't have to dress a certain way, right? I mean, you're okay in jeans and you're okay in a suit, right? There are, of course, limits in terms of modesty, but generally we wear what is comfortable. And another rule is that you don't have to have your hair look in a certain way, right? So if you want blue hair, it wouldn't suit me, but it might look good on you, right? So we don't have those. Rules. There aren't any rules about the political party that you support. There aren't any rules about the even. Get this. This may shock you. Even the brand of coffee that you drink. Look, and I hope you see that. As you come here, I hope you see that. But here's a deeper question. And I think we all do get that. I think, you know, if you've been around for a little while, I hope you see that. But here's a deeper question, one that doesn't get asked a lot. But we're talking about it all the time, but not really talking about it. We're not saying anything, but we're talking about it all the time. And the question is this. What behaviors and sins are people not allowed to struggle with here? Wow. See, it goes deeper than just surface level where he's wearing a shirt, he's wearing a t-shirt, he's wearing a suit and tie. This is much deeper than that. What are we not allowed to struggle with? So is it okay to not be okay? Right? Now, this is not an excuse for sin. This is struggling with sin. What sin are you allowed to struggle with? So you see, God to Jeremiah pictures this scene that one day, I think it's Jeremiah 50, that one day that God's people would come together weeping. They would come together weeping and seeking God's face. That's how God pictures the people of God, coming together weeping to seek God's face. And look, a lot of these things are kind of unstated, right? I mean, I don't think any of us will want to intentionally exclude anyone, but I think that those rules become quickly apparent to anyone who walks into the life of our church. Look, if everybody looks the same, and if certain sins are ridiculed as being beneath a Christian to struggle with them, then if people come from a different place, they either have to conform to those rules or they go somewhere else. That's legalism. And when they do go somewhere else, and here's the tragedy, when they do go somewhere else, they often go more broken than when they arrived. Because we've just become another reason for them to dismiss the reality of Jesus and the power of the gospel because we don't embrace diversity like the gospel does. Thirdly, let me move on. The third thing, which is really an implication of the first two, actually, is not only about breaking down all barriers and we rooting out legalism, but also that we love across differences. And this is really kind of the heart of the issue. We love across differences. You know, unity is not the same as uniformity. But also unity is not the same as unanimity. You'd be like, I don't know. Let me help you with that. Unanimity means that we all have to agree. Okay? So unanimity means that we all have to agree. But that isn't unity. It's not biblical unity. Unity is that we are united in our diversity. That's what unity is. That's what unity speaks of. Let me give you an example. The leadership team here, we have a board of elders, and then we have a wider leadership team that are responsible for different areas of ministry in the church. on that leadership team, we have some Calvinists and we have Arminianists. We have pre-millennialists, post-millennialists, amillennialists, and people that don't know what days mean. We have Pentecostals and cessationists. We have people from Brethren backgrounds. We have people from Baptist backgrounds. We have Presbyterian backgrounds and no background at all. Well, they have a background, but not a church background. At times, listen, at times, we're going to disagree. Right? For sure we're going to disagree. But that's okay. That's absolutely okay. It's how we disagree that testifies to the gospel at work amongst us. It's not that we don't disagree. You know, if we all just get on and we all agree and we say, well, yeah, we agree to this, and if we can't agree, then we leave, that's not a good testimony to the gospel. A good testimony to the gospel is, as we've seen, the gospel is that God takes people out of every different walk of life from every different background, places them in one body and says, all right, love each other. That's what my image is right there. That's how the world's going to know that you love me, is that you love each other. We're going to disagree. It's how we disagree that is the really, really important thing. Otherwise, look, what do you make of all those verses that command forgiveness? I mean, what do you do with those verses? I mean, in the church, Christians, we're supposed to forgive, right? If you didn't know that, we are, all right? It's kind of like 101 Christianity. And what do you do with those verses that tell us to love one another? I mean, the nature of love isn't, I'm going to love you if you love me. That's not love. That's not Christ's love. That's not grace. Grace is, I'm going to love you despite the fact that actually you're acting like an idiot right now. Which is what the leadership team say to me quite often. That's what love is. That's what grace is. See, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, if you love those who love you, what is your reward? Because even the Gentiles do that. Right? You're no different. We're no different from, we should just be a club. And you should just pay your dues, come on time, and then leave, and we're done. Things would be a lot easier and cleaner if we did that, right? Jesus is saying that's what the Gentiles do. Romans, Paul said, Romans chapter 12, if it is possible, and it's if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. He doesn't say separate from all men. He says, as much as you can, live peaceably with them. Flick over the page if you're still in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12. Put on then, Paul says, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, patience, bearing with one another. It's not like as soon as you fall out, you're out of here. As soon as you don't agree on everything, you're out of here. That's not what Paul says. Paul says you've got to bear with one another. And if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other as the Lord has forgiven you. It goes back to the gospel. You see, there is a need within this for a healthy understanding of sin as well, isn't there? Because one of the chief barriers to unity is pride. And pride causes people from one group to look down on people from another group. But the goal isn't to get, and this is, we make a big mistake in churches thinking this. The goal is not to get good people to love bad people. Right? It's to get the good people to realize that they're no better than the bad people. And to get the bad people to realize that they stand united in their sin and in need of a savior, just like everyone else. Right? It's not about good versus bad. We're all bad, but by God's grace. Having that healthy understanding of sin all of a sudden stops competition. It stops jealousy. It stops pride. It stops divisions unnecessarily. And once that happens, you see the love of Christ is displayed in the gospel being worked out in the unity of the church as it loves across differences. It's the middle class church that is willing to reach out to the poor because they know the gospel. It's the English speaking church that is willing to love Eastern Europeans when no one else does. It's the families reaching singles because they remember what it was like to be single. It's the singles reaching out to children because they remember everybody else is too old. They remember what it was like to be a child. It's the older men training up younger men because they've been through every pitfall and every disaster and they're wiser than you are. It's the older woman training up the younger woman. When your kids have been sick for 3 years, it's the older woman who comes alongside you. It's that that is going to testify to the power of the gospel in our community. The gospel doesn't say that we are all the same. It's not uniformity and it's not unanimity. It says that in our differences, we're one in Christ. And it's the way we maintain that oneness despite our differences that displays Christ. And look, we would be silly to think that these things, doing church together, is going to come naturally and automatically. We were silly, we'd be foolish, right? Doing church together is hard work. And it's hard work because we're sinful people, right? We need more of God's grace, more of God's mercy. And Christian unity must be diligently preserved and promoted. Diligently preserved and promoted. We must control our tongues. We must avoid gossip. We must be quick to encourage, slow to rebuke. We must be gentle. We must be humble while receiving rebuke. We should be reaching out to those who are in need, not reaching out to those who are like us. We must be committed to the preservation and practice of Christian unity if it is ever going to be evident to the world around us that God loves them. And so I hope that that gives you some food for thought. I'm going to pray, and Joe and Emily are going to lead us in a few songs. And just want to encourage you, unity is one of those things. You start talking about unity, and unity comes in the front door and tends to leave very quickly out the back door. And whenever Paul talks about unity, it's always corrective. Always. He's always writing to a church and saying, you're not united. And I hesitate to say that I think we're doing okay by God's grace, but we could be doing better. And I think there's some certain things, Colossians talks about how we need to forgive one another. And, Jesus says, before you come to the altar, leave your sacrifice at the altar and go and be made right with a person. Now, Paul didn't say that, and I didn't say that. Jesus said that. And so I want to encourage you, we try just to have a time where we can just reflect and think about these things before we kind of just launch into singing. I want to encourage you that If there's something on your heart that you feel that's just not right, there's maybe division between you and another person and it's unnecessary. Maybe you just think, you know, sometimes you overhear things maybe sometimes and you just, that kind of wears on you over weeks and months and you just think that person's got it in for you. And they haven't at all. It's just like they've had a really busy week or they're going through this thing. And they looked at you strangely 3 months ago and that was it. And so go and sort that out. If you need forgiveness because you've wronged a brother and sister, go and sort that out. Don't come to the altar and think you can worship God and that be undealt with. And so we're going to spend some time just quietly. Joan, Emily are going to come up and you can pray one to another. Maybe there's someone here this morning who's been wronged by someone. Maybe that person who have wronged them is not even here. Maybe it's a different church. Maybe it's not even a church. And you just need to work through that. Maybe you're struggling with something. Can I say again, it's okay to struggle here. It's okay to struggle. We are all struggling. And so maybe you're struggling. Maybe you just need support. Come and find that support. Laurie and I are up the front. We're more than happy to pray for you. Tim and Sheena right here, we're more than happy to pray. They're more than happy to pray for you. Find someone, turn to someone who you know, ask them to pray for you. And we'll do that now just before Joe and Emily start to lead us.
You have been listening to a teaching ministry of Calvary Southampton. For more information, go to www.calvarysoughton.co.uk.